Well, good morning, everyone. I do not take any offense at all that Valerie shouts out, "Yes, we get to go downstairs," right when it's my turn to get up. Oh, that's delightful. Man, this has been one of those weeks for me. I got colds, and we had a little car accident, and insurance issues, and all these frustrating things going on. But on the bright side, I got my lucky sermon socks back, so there. we'll see if that makes a difference. Yeah. Touch and see, Jesus tells his disciples in today's gospel passage. And on the surface of things, this could not be a more everyday, mundane sort of statement. There are many things in this world that we regularly touch and see, and taste, and smell, and hear, for that matter. So his simple invitation this morning appears rather ordinary. Touch and see. And yet, what I'd like to suggest to you this morning is that those three words are at the heart of what resurrection truly means. Touch and see. And to help explain all that, I'd like to begin with this. Every once in a while, I feel compelled to go and read C.S. Lewis. This was one of those weeks, and so you're getting a bit of a taste of that. Do you recall the final installment of C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia? Remember those seven books? The final installment, Lewis titled The Last Battle. Remember this? There's a curious little story right near the end that I think might be helpful for us as we consider the gospel passage we've received this morning. It has to do with a dozen of Lewis's dazzling creatures that make up the world of Narnia, who find themselves right on the cusp of this brand new world that is occurring after the last battle. A resurrection world, in fact, we might call it. The scene occurs right after the eponymous last battle. These 12 creatures and a host of others find themselves in a new Narnia, similar to the old Narnia, but now shimmering somehow. A world made fully alive, suddenly sparkling with a presence they've never quite experienced before. Or rather, that is how most of the creatures in Lewis's story experience this new Narnia. All of them, save for our 12 creatures who huddle together in a circle. They're a group of strong-willed, strong-hearted, strong-bodied beings who've been all throughout the stories, but they saw something that day in Narnia entirely different from everyone else. In fact, dreadfully different. Although they stood in the very same space as everyone else, they experienced that world not as light and life as everyone around them saw it, but rather as darkness and despair. And the question is, in Lewis's story, in this glorious, great moment of victory, why? Why could this circle of 12 not simply look around and see the world as everyone else saw it? A world that was alive. At this point in the story, we don't know the answer yet to why they can't see it in this way. All we know is that either they could not or perhaps would not see the world any differently. And so this group of 12, if you recall the story, they huddle together in a tight circle, closing themselves off to this new day dawning all around them. And enter poor old Lucy, kind-hearted Lucy. Lucy is beside herself with grief for these 12 souls. No matter how she tries, no matter how she encourages them, no matter what she attempts to provide for them in the way of evidence, those 12 simply would not turn and see the world shimmering around them, telling Lucy only this: we won't be duped into believing your lies. And so Lucy begins to weep, and she turns to Aslan, the Christ character in this story, pleading for the lion to help. "Dearest Lucy," Aslan replies, "I will show you both what I can and what I cannot do." So Aslan, he comes close, if you remember how the scene goes, he comes close to that circle of 12, and he gives a low growl. And Lewis writes, "That growl sets all the air to shaking." But those beloved creatures refuse to hear it for what it is. It's just the gang at the other side of the pit, they reason, trying to frighten us. They do it with a machine of some kind. Don't take any notice to that noise. Again, Aslan raises his head, shakes his great mane, and a wondrous feast of food and wine appears before the 12. And though they eat, they're unable to taste any of its goodness. There's no pleasure in their feast. "We won't let anyone take us in," they say. "It's all just another lie." At which point, Aslan turns to Lucy and finally explains, "You see, they will not let us help them. Their prison is only in their minds, yet they are in fact in that prison, and so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out." And Lucy is bewildered. The whole world is now charged with the grandeur of God, alive with the dearest freshness deep down things, as the poet Gerard Manley Hopkins so memorably put it. And yet those dozen souls simply cannot see it, or rather refuse to see the resurrection world that is in fact all around them. Well, I share that sad scene from Narnia with you because I believe it relates directly to the central lesson of our gospel reading this morning. You know, in one sense, it's sort of a strange thing that we've even received this particular passage 3 weeks into Easter. For 3 Sundays in a row now, our gospel readings have highlighted the exact same story. I wonder if you've noticed that. For 3 weeks in a row, we've actually heard the same story over and over and over again. Each week, we've heard the same exact resurrection scene, simply told from a different perspective. Twice from John, and now this one from Luke. And the question is, why? Why does the lectionary give us the same scene over and over and over again throughout Easter? Haven't we already heard the message already? Don't we know that the tomb is empty? Haven't we already placed our hands in the scars last week? Why read the same scene again and again and again? And the answer, I think, is something like this. Our lectionary readings are a reminder for us that, in fact, it's not enough to simply say that the tomb is empty. It's not enough to proclaim Christ is risen. It's not enough even to believe in the resurrection. As essential as each of those is, none of them are enough. Because in the end, the goal is not to affirm the resurrection, but rather the goal is to experience it. And until we do that, we're rather like those 12 strange and stubborn souls on the cusp of a reborn world, present without actually perceiving. And as Lewis describes it in his novel, their failure to experience resurrection world was the result of one basic flaw. Quite simply, they were imprisoned in a worldview that would not let them see. You see, according to those 12, as Lewis makes clear as the novel goes on, heaven and earth, for those 12, are in fact two separate things. Spirit and matter are two separate things. God and creation are two separate things. So that when Narnia is claiming to now combine those two, they had already decided that simply was not possible. And so they could not perceive. Which is, intriguingly, precisely what Jesus encounters when he appears to his disciples in Luke 24 in today's gospel reading. While they were still pondering the empty tomb, Luke writes, Jesus himself stood among them. And just as we anticipate this emotional reunion full of hugs and happy tears when Jesus appears, what we get instead, Luke tells us, is just the opposite. Christ's arrival scares the bejesus out of these disciples. They were startled, Luke tells us, terrified, which frankly is entirely understandable. If one of my deceased loved ones were to appear in my living room, startled would barely begin to describe my response. Soiled might be more accurate. And sensing their terror, Jesus seeks to comfort them. And he says to them, Shalom Aleichem, in his usual Aramaic, peace be with you. But his words do little to calm their nerves. Indeed, they thought, Luke says, they were seeing a ghost. For though they see him, they do not perceive. Though they hear him, they do not yet understand. The tomb has been opened, but their minds remain closed. Like those 12 in Lewis's novel, they're simply unable to recognize the resurrection that really stands right before them. And for the very same reason as those 12 in Lewis's novel. A creature can only be one thing or another, spirit or matter. You can be heaven or you can be earth. You can be God or you can be human. It cannot be both, they believed. And since they know that the human Jesus died, well, this Jesus before them must certainly be a spirit. In other words, they continue to think, those disciples in that upper room, they continue to think in the bifurcated world of either or, separating spirit and matter, divinity and humanity, heaven and earth. And in so doing, they deny themselves the ability to perceive what is right there in their midst. Again, the tomb has been opened, but their minds remain closed. And so, Jesus speaks those wondrous words with which we began. So simple, and yet so utterly profound. Jesus says to them, touch and see. Their current categories only allow for Jesus to be some sort of disembodied spirit. So, Jesus seeks to transform that worldview with his invitation, touch and see. And he holds out his hands and he shows them his feet. And when that's not enough, Jesus offers up his tongue, his teeth, his esophagus, his stomach, and his intestines as well. Last week, we saw Jesus appearing in locked rooms. And this week, we see him eating broiled tilapia. The resurrected life, apparently, is porous enough to walk right through the walls we erect all around us, and yet solid enough to hold down that fish. The marriage of heaven and earth, of spirit and matter, of God and creation, has been consummated right here in the risen Jesus. Jesus' resurrection shatters the separation that we build between those two. And so Jesus does not point them to some other world for an encounter with the divine, but what Jesus says is this. He invites them to touch and see God right here in this world. In the human hands and feet, in mouth and teeth, heaven and earth are in fact made one. And yet, the degree to which all of us have allowed ourselves to be bound by the either-or of spirit or matter, humanity or divinity, heaven or earth, is the very degree to which we will be unable to recognize the resurrected life right here in our midst. What the resurrected life of Christ reveals is that in this world, this place, this time, we are filled, we are infused with, we are suffused by God here and now. That is the divine reality we are invited by Jesus to touch and to see. Not some future time and place, but heaven on earth, here and now, in our very midst, if only we will see. According to Luke, which is where I presume C.S. Lewis first learned all this in the first place, a resurrection experience happens when we risk unbinding ourselves, when we are set free from our usual ways of perceiving the world, and when we allow the extraordinary truth of our scripture to sink in. Heaven and earth have now become one, which is precisely what happened to Jesus' disciples as they extended their trembling fingers to poke Jesus right in the side. In Lewis's last battle, it was Farsight the Eagle, appropriately, who first began to perceive. We have all been blind, he says, as the reality of the resurrection world dawned upon him. We are only now, finally, beginning to see. It was the same world as always, and yet now, truly seen for what it was. As C.S. Lewis explains, perhaps you'll get some idea of it if you think like this. You may have been in a room in which there was a window that looked out on a lovely bay or a sea, or a green valley that wound its way among the mountains. And in the wall of that room, opposite to the window, there may have been a mirror. As you turned away from the window, you suddenly caught sight of the sea or the valley all over again in the mirror. And the scene in the mirror was, in one sense, just the same scene as the one in the window. Yet at the same time, it was somehow different, deeper, more wonderful. The difference between the old Narnia and the new Narnia was like that. The new one was a deeper country. Every rock and flower, every blade of grass looked as if it meant more. I can't describe it any better than that, Lewis confesses, but if you ever get there, you'll know precisely what I mean. And that, I'd like to suggest, is the resurrection experience to which Jesus invites us today. It's not some other world we're being invited to. It is this world, transformed. Transformed by recognizing the risen Christ, heaven and earth, right here among us, which is both the gift and the challenge of the Easter resurrection stories. In the end, Lewis writes, it was the unicorn who summed up what everyone was feeling. I have come home at last. This is my real country. I belong here. This is the land I've been looking for all my life, though I never knew it till just now. And that land that the unicorn saw, that land is right here, among us, underneath our feet. In the resurrection, this world is now charged with the grandeur of God, alive with the dearest freshness deep down things. And our call is simply this: come, let us touch, and let us see. Amen.